to be announced, maybe let Mr. Wetzel know, and he can make that announcement with the last hymn this afternoon. So I'll go ahead and get into the main message, and we'll skip or forego the extra hymn. I want to take you back this afternoon to my high school days. Now, many of you probably don't want to go back to those days, and I don't go back that far very often, and it was a long time ago, and some of those memories have faded. Some memories have stayed with me. But the example that I want to bring out this afternoon as an introduction to this message is I want to go back to the time that I was freshman, sophomore in high school, and I played basketball for the high school team. And that was a long time ago, trust me. But I enjoyed those particular years of playing high school basketball. It was a great experience. I was in the church. I wasn't baptized, but my family was in the church, and so I had to navigate around the Sabbath and the Saturdays, and that was a learning experience as well. But when I think back to this particular experience that I had the opportunity to go through, we had a basketball coach that was a great teacher, a fantastic teacher. And as a group of 15 and 16 and maybe 17-year-olds, if we were patient enough and quiet enough and still enough to really stand and listen as he would talk to us, we could learn a lot. And there were moments in the basketball practices when he would blow the whistle and we'd all gather around and he would give us that teaching moment. And he had a couple of sayings that really impressed upon me as a very young man that have stayed with me. He actually had a number of things that he was trying to teach us, all young, growing, and energetic teenage boys. But a couple things that I want to bring out this afternoon. One of the things that he always taught us, and always kept drilling in our heads, is that if you keep the other team from scoring, you cannot lose the game. And that's true. Now, his point behind all of this was he wanted to make sure that we played defense and that we bought into playing defense to keep the other team from scoring. That we could, in many ways, control the outcome of the game by playing defense. And for any of you who have ever played basketball, it's when you're on the defensive end that generates the most energy from you. You have to be on your toes at all times. And then the other saying that he would always give us is he said that you play just like you practice. Now that's true in life of many things. So if we were goofing off in practice, you know, we would eventually goof off at some point in the game. Or if we made a bad decision in practice, that same opportunity would come in a game, and we'd probably do the same thing. And if we didn't play great defense in practice, we probably weren't going to play defense in the game. And then certainly, if we didn't prepare correctly, we were not going to perform correctly, or at least we would not perform at his level in the game. Now, this particular coach was a great coach and a real stickler for conditioning. And the part that I remember a lot about my basketball experience was all of the conditioning that we would have to go through at the beginning of the season. You know, it was a grand goal to think that we would run through the year and we would stay in shape and we would come to basketball and we would all be in shape, but unfortunately that was not the case. Another one of the things that he drilled into us was that it's not always the best team that wins. It's the team that finishes the best or the strongest will often walk away off the court with the win. So the first 3 weeks of basketball practice, those were the weeks that I dreaded most because conditioning was a major part of this particular man's grooming to get us ready for the basketball season. And so we were told over and over again that if we didn't push our bodies, if we didn't make it hurt, that was his favorite term, if you don't make it hurt, you'll never improve. And so his purpose was to make us hurt, physically that is, to push ourselves. And so he would push us to where our bodies would struggle. We would suffer with loss of breath and aching muscles. And if we didn't push our bodies physically, we knew that we wouldn't get stronger physically. We wouldn't have the endurance that we needed, the stamina that we needed, the endurance and the fortitude to play the game all the way to the end, the full 32 minutes. I think that we had four quarters of 8 minutes. So we wouldn't play the game all the way to the end. So he would push us physically to make sure that we were in shape. And he told us that without this physical adversity, your bodies cannot physically get stronger. And there was a lot of truth to that. And we know there's truth to that. And so the first 3 weeks of practice were quite torturous, but also fun at the same time. The running drills were the things I dreaded the most, but I know that I knew that we had to go through them because that's how we were going to get stronger. And at the end of every practice, we did what was referred to as running the lines. How many know what that is? Few of you. Well, running the lines was certainly one of those difficult drills. Now, a basketball court is 94 feet in length from baseline to baseline. And so the court in running the lines was broken up from one baseline to the next foul line, then back to the baseline. Then you run from the baseline to the half-court line, then back to the baseline. Then you'd run down to the following foul line, back to the baseline. And then you had to run from baseline to baseline and come back. If you didn't touch one of those points with your foot or your hand, it did not count. You had to do that drill again. So we made sure that we went at least beyond that line so that we didn't have to repeat that drill. And of course, he pushed us for about a half an hour to do this. And we had one fellow on the team. I think he was the tallest fellow on the team. He was around 6'4", and he probably weighed 140 pounds soaking wet. It was all legs. Now, if you're on a football field and doing a 100-yard dash, he could do really well. But this fellow with all legs, running 20 feet and coming back, running 46 feet and coming back, tough on him. And so he struggled with that. And, of course, when you do these drills, you're pushing yourself, you're out of breath, we're all bent over. And the coach always told us, don't bend over, don't grab your knees, don't grab your shorts, stand up, walk around. If you don't, you'll get sick. And those of us who didn't listen would, typically, at some point in practice, we would have to run to the bathroom or run to the closest trash can. And this particular fellow, he dubbed these drills as hellbenders, because he said it was like hell going through it, and we were all bent over when we were finished. Now, I think they're actually called suicides or something like that, but we always got a chuckle out of him complaining about having to run these drills. But at the end of the third week of practice, this was our graduation in that sense from a conditioning perspective. Running the lines, as I described to you, we had to be able to run one of those under 30 seconds. And then the last week of practice, we had to run two of those back to back under 60 seconds. And that was tough. And you were exhausted after running a double trip under 60 seconds. And that last week, he was so focused on conditioning that we would run two sets, we'd have 3 minutes, and we would run another two sets. And if we didn't pass those sets, two sets under 60 minutes each, or under 60 seconds each, then we had to take 10 minutes and run around the gym. We were already tired, so nobody wanted to do that. But the physical conditioning that we went through paid off in the long run. They paid huge dividends over the course of the basketball season because our stamina and our endurance came through oftentimes in the games, especially toward the end of the games. The other team might be at that point slowing down. We were just speeding up. We had plenty of energy left in that sense. And as I described the process of running the lines, you know, none of us liked doing that, but at the end of the 3 weeks, we certainly understood the improvement. Because if we had tried to do that on the first day of practice, none of us could have done that. But at the end of 3 weeks, before the games began, the whole team could run two of those drills under 60 seconds. And it was amazing, By pushing our bodies physically that way, how our conditioning improved, how our stamina improved, how our endurance improved. Well, our spiritual growth and endurance spiritually works the same way. We have to go through testing, and we have to go through adversity, and we have to go through some form of suffering or trials, as we often talk about, or we will not develop the spiritual endurance or the stamina or the spiritual character that we all need. There is a direct correlation. What our bodies go through physically and are able to grow and excel, that same relationship exists spiritually, that we have to go through a certain amount of adversity in order to grow spiritually. So how should we view adversity? How should we view trials? What should our approach to hardships be? How should we look at those? How does God want us to look at the concept or the subject of trials and testing, of having to go through adversity? So this afternoon, what I would like to cover in this particular message is how should we approach the concept and the reality of adversity? Mr. Buchanan, in his sermonette, touched on this quite a bit, actually. And out of all of the tens of thousands of scriptures in the Bible, he and I picked the same one. He only used three, and he got one of mine. But we'll talk about that in a moment. But you know, difficult times are a part of life. And you can go through the pages of the Bible, beginning in Genesis, all the way through Revelation. And the Bible is filled with stories about God's people going through adversity, going through trials. And so difficult times are a part of this physical life, our human life. As long as we are alive, we will face adversity. As long as we live, we will have some form of trial, some form of suffering that we all go through. There aren't any shortcuts, by the way. There's no way to get around this. It will happen to us. And so just as our basketball team was pushed physically to build endurance and stamina, God provides the means and the ways for all of us to be pushed spiritually in order to develop spiritual character growth. And so in times of adversity, we as God's people come to see ourselves in a different light. Hopefully we do. And hopefully that our strengths and our weaknesses, as we go through adversity and trials, they are revealed to us. You know, when life hits us the hardest, that's when we understand what our true strengths and our true weaknesses are. But how do we view adversity? How do we approach it? How do we handle it? What does God hope that we learn from going through trials, afflictions, suffering, adversity, whatever name you want to call it? What does God hope that we learn from it? Let's turn over to Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5, and I'm going to read from the Revised Standard Version. But in Romans chapter 5, and beginning in verse 3, Romans 5, beginning in verse 3, more than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance. Really, Paul, do we really rejoice? When's the last time you rejoiced and when you had a big trial? You know, that's not one of the things that we typically and humanly want to do. So here Paul says that we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that the suffering produces endurance. Now, the Greek word that's translated endurance simply means the ability to stand firm. The ability to stand firm. And the Expositor's Bible Dictionary, in commenting on this particular verse, says knowing that suffering produces the ability to be patient and steadfast under the weight of adversity. And so here we see this encouragement that's coming from Paul, that we are to view trials and adversity maybe in a slightly different light than we like to view it. Paul says there's a certain element to be thankful for, to rejoice over. Continuing in verse 4, he says, "And endurance produces character, and character produces hope." And then in verse 5, "Hope does not disappoint us, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which He has been given to us." And of course, that hope that we all have is the hope of eternal life, the hope of being in God's family. So physical endurance is built by pushing ourselves physically, and by exercising the body, and spiritual endurance is developed by being tested, having to face adversity, having to face and confront whatever adversity or trial comes upon us. So hardships, trials, adversity, they all strengthen us. They all give us strength in our spiritual fortitude. They all help us to understand where we need to grow, where we need to improve our weaknesses, and where we can add to our strengths. Let's turn back to Proverbs chapter 24. Proverbs chapter 24. Adversity also produces patience and humility, as we'll see in a moment. And the adversity that we go through in this life really helps mold our character. And that's what God's concerned about. But in Proverbs chapter 24, we're going to look at one verse. Proverbs chapter 24 and verse 10. "If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small." Again, much truth to what Solomon is saying here, or actually what God is saying through Solomon. And so this is true both physically and spiritually. Is that if we have no endurance, then it's likely that our journey is going to require us to go through a lot more conditioning. And so if we cannot endure physically, it's going to take a lot more conditioning. And if we don't endure spiritually, then we're going to have to face more adversity in order for that to improve. Theodore Roosevelt made the following statement. He says, "Nothing in this world is worth having or worth doing unless it means effort, pain, and difficulty. I have never in my life envied a human being who led an easy life, but I have envied a great many people who led difficult lives and led them well." Billy Graham made the following comment. It says, "Comfort and prosperity have never enriched the world nearly as much as adversity has." And then finally, Helen Keller, she made this statement. She says, "A happy life consists not in the absence, but in the mastery of hardships." You know, and there's truth in all of those quotes that we just read. There's an element of truth in all of that. Spiritually speaking, a lot of truth. Let's turn back to, or over to, 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and let's begin in verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, and beginning in verse 16. It says, "Therefore we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day." Verse 17, "For our light affliction," really? Are most of our trials and adversity light? I guess I have had a few that were light. But a lot of them are heavy, aren't they? But Paul says it's our light affliction. Now what he's doing here, he's not making light of adversity that we go through, but he's trying to get us to understand what trials are, what suffering means in the context of our spiritual life. He says, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." So Paul looked at suffering, adversity, trials as being something that we go through, but it helps us to get to our goal, and that is eternal life. And so in that context, Paul is saying, yes, when you look at it from that perspective, whatever we have to go through is light compared to what God has promised that He's willing to give us. And then continuing in verse 18, he says, "While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal." And so here Paul is encouraging us to look at adversity from the perspective of God's point of view. We're in this physical existence only as a blink of the eye compared to eternity. And really, that's not even a comparison, but that's as close as I can get, because none of us know how long eternity is. None of us can relate to that. But what Paul is showing us and trying to encourage us with here is that whatever affliction or adversity that we go through, it is minor compared to what God has in store for us. When we go through testing and suffering or trials, however we refer to it, sometimes it's because of our bad choice. Sometimes it's because of choices that we make. Mr. Buchanan talked about that in his sermonette. Sometimes it is the result of our bad choices. There are other times when we suffer or we go through adversity because of other people's choices. And then, of course, there's that third category, and that is we sometimes suffer simply because of time and chance. But none of us look forward to facing adversity. No one is going to raise their hand and say, "Bring it on. Give it to me. I can handle it." You know, I think we all pray that God spare us, that God be merciful to us, that God protect us, and that protection is to keep us out of difficulty or keeping us out of trouble. So none of us look forward to going through adversity. None of us are going to ask God to bring on the difficult times, to bring on severe trials. At least I don't think we do. I don't think any of us are going to ask for that. In fact, most of us, when we find ourselves in a difficult situation, we're pouring our hearts out to God to, you know, "Get me out of this. Take this away. Help me. I've had enough." You know, we've all had that prayer. "Help me. Do something." You know, and we all have that promise that God is not going to allow us to be tested beyond what we can endure or stand or be able to face. But none of us really want to go through adversity. None of us really want to have difficulties or hardships. Some of those can be extremely emotional. Some can be extremely debilitating physically. But none of us really want to go through that. And as a parent, many of us are, you know, when we look at our children, we hope to be able to encourage them. We hope to protect them. We hope to keep them from going through trials or heartache or suffering. And so as we all know that we have a loving Father, as a parent, doesn't He want the same thing? You know, and God certainly does love us, and it's really because of His love for us that He does allow trials and adversity or affliction to come upon us, because it's a tool for Him to train and groom and help us to grow in godly character. So God does allow a certain amount of hardship or adversity to come before us, because it's the only way that there's a type of growth that we can accomplish. It's the only way that we as humans have an opportunity to put on certain type of character growth and a certain level of righteousness that God knows that we all need. And so God allows certain things to come before us and challenge us, because it exposes maybe some of our weaknesses. And as we work through in prayer and study and meditation, you know, when we see those weaknesses, we can make changes. And that's what God is hoping that we all come to. And of course, then there's suffering that we go through because of sin. And we'll look at an example of that in the Bible here shortly. But when sin is involved, sometimes that those trials can be extremely difficult. And what God is looking for in those situations is bringing us to a process of correction or repentance so that He can help us and so that He can groom us and show us how to overcome, help us to overcome, and help us develop a pure heart and a heart of gratitude and a heart of seeking after God's righteousness. So the Bible is filled with a lot of examples of adversity, but I want to begin with looking at the story of Joseph. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 37, because this is a remarkable story and there's a lot of lessons here for all of us. We're not going to read the four or five chapters, or really it's more like 10 chapters, but I'm going to highlight some things out of Joseph's life that I hope will help us see how God used, or how God groomed him through some of the adversity that Joseph had to go through. But let's go back to Genesis chapter 37. We'll pick up the story there, and beginning in verse 2. Genesis 37, beginning in verse 2. Now Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report to them, or of them, to his father. So right away we're introduced to some interesting challenges in Jacob's family. There are sons from different wives. And there's no doubt some jealousy and competition that's going on. We're told later that Jacob actually loved Joseph more than any of the other boys. Now, that doesn't make for a very good situation. And I think his parents and his children, and we've all been children once, we may not all have been parents, but we've all been children once, if our parents had favored one over another, that would be pretty obvious. And there would be a certain harmfulness or hurt feelings that would come from that. But we're told that Jacob loves Joseph the most, and I'm sure his brothers knew that and felt that. So the story goes on that Joseph has a couple of dreams, still a young teenager here, and in his excitement he tells the dreams to his brother, or to his brothers, and really to his father, and it doesn't go over very well. They're even more jealous of him. They already resented him prior to this, and now they even resent him more. And so as a 17-year-old teenager, maybe Joseph didn't have quite the discretion that maybe, you know, we would have liked to have seen him had. But his brothers want to do away with him. And Judah convinces them that rather than killing Joseph, it would be better if they just sold Joseph. And so they sold him to a group of traders that were going down into Egypt. And this begins the story of Joseph, where he is now going to go through a long period of adversity. You know, did Joseph cause this through his own bad decisions or choices? Or was something else here at play? We'll look at this more closely as we go through this story. Now let's skip forward to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis 39, and beginning in verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Verse 2, and the Eternal was with Joseph. Now here we see this phrase that God was with Joseph, and this is going to be repeated a number of times through this particular story of Joseph. The Bible doesn't tell us when Joseph understood that God was had a hand in this, but we see here that God was with Joseph, and God is a part of this process. So it says, the Eternal was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And so God has a purpose for Joseph. And Joseph may not have thought about it in those terms, maybe didn't identify his life with that at that particular moment. But Joseph now becomes a very prominent servant in the house of Potiphar. And this probably happens pretty quickly because God is involved with him, he's blessing him, and there are certain traits and leadership abilities that begin to come out from Joseph. And so during this height of Joseph as a servant within Potiphar's house, he's approached by Potiphar's wife, and he's approached to sleep with her, but he flees her advances. And in order to protect herself, she turned the table on Joseph. You know, Joseph did exactly what God would expect all of us to do. In that situation where temptation is in front of us, what does the Bible tell us to do? It says flee. So Joseph, rightfully so, he fled from that situation. But then the tables are turned on him, and now he is going to be treated even more harshly because of what Potiphar's wife accuses him of. And then dropping down to verse 20 of Genesis chapter 39. And then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. Now, if you want to do some research about what does it mean to go into the king's prison, well, it's a place that you are not supposed to ever leave from. The king's prison was where all of the enemies of the state went. You were handled with great cruelty, oftentimes. A lot of that cruelty would lead to death. Sometimes you were later executed. Sometimes you were left there to simply rot. And so here we see that Joseph ends up in the king's prison with other of the king's prisoners. And he was there in the prison. In verse 21, here we see that comment again, but the Eternal was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison, whatever they did there, it was his doing. So in a little bit of insight here in this particular part of the story, Joseph has certain traits that God is teaching him and training him in. You know, here we begin to see Joseph is learning about leadership. Now he may, in fact, I can guarantee you, Joseph never thought once about learning leadership in prison. But God was working with him. God was teaching him. And as verse 23 tells us, the guard of the prison knew that there was something special about Joseph. Verse 23, the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him. Now, the guard didn't know that, but Joseph's actions made things happen in a very favorable way inside the prison, and probably in a very favorable way for the guard or guards. And so the Eternal was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. So Joseph probably at some point in time during this period that he was in prison, no doubt understood that God was assisting him, that God had not left him, that God was working with him through this situation. And I'm sure Joseph prayed over and over again, well, God, rather than blessing me in this place, take me out of here. We would have all prayed that prayer. The Bible doesn't tell us how long Joseph was in prison, but we'll touch on that in a moment. But it was probably a number of years. And Joseph probably, no doubt, understood that God was helping him. God was opening doors for him, even though he was in prison. And I'm sure Joseph prayed fervently that God would take him out, get him out of that place. Let's go down to now chapter 40. As we lead up to chapter 40, or as we get to chapter 40, the king's butler and the baker were thrown into the prison. So they had a falling out with the king. And they both had a dream, and Joseph revealed the meaning of the dreams to them. Now let's pick up the story in verse 14. Genesis chapter 40, the beginning of verse 14. But remember me, he's talking to both individuals here, but specifically to the butler. He says, remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me, make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. So Joseph wanted out. And he knew the meaning of the dream, that the butler was going to be restored. And Joseph was asking him for a favor. Tell the king about me so that I can get out of his place. But he goes on in verse 15. He says, for indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and I also have done nothing here that they should put me into this dungeon. And so Joseph, during this period of time in his life, he knew he didn't do anything that would have caused his brothers to kill him or to sell him, or at least in his mind, he didn't do anything. And he certainly knew that he did nothing that was deserving his sentence in prison. He knew he was being obedient to God. And so here Joseph is expressing to the two individuals here, again, primarily the butler, that tell the king about me, I am innocent. And hopefully the king, or not the king, but the Pharaoh, hopefully the Pharaoh would get him out of prison. But the story goes on, we're told that the butler, who was in fact restored, as Joseph revealed through the dream, didn't mention Joseph to the Pharaoh. And so 2 years go by, and now Pharaoh has two dreams, and he was troubled by these dreams. And he dreams that greatly caused him stress. No one can interpret those. But the butler now remembers about this Hebrew man in prison who was able to interpret his dream. And so Pharaoh now calls for Joseph, and Joseph reveals the meaning of the Pharaoh's dreams. And then he goes on to recommend to the Pharaoh what he should do based upon the revelation of what these dreams mean. Now let's pick up the story in Genesis chapter 41 and in verse 39. In Genesis 41 and in verse 39. And then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all of this, there is no one as discerning and as wise as you. Now that was a major statement for Pharaoh to make, because the Egyptians despised the Hebrews. And then we're told that later in the story. And so this was an amazing statement that came from the Pharaoh. But continuing in verse 40, he says, you shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. Verse 41, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all of the land of Egypt. So there was something that Pharaoh recognized in Joseph, probably with God's help. And it was beyond just the ability to interpret these two dreams. And then in verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, and he went throughout all of the land of Egypt. So Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers at age 17. And here he is, 30 years of age, standing before Pharaoh. So 13 years of his life. What became of those years? Much of it, I believe, was probably spent in prison. But let's continue in verse 50. And to Joseph were born two sons before the years of the famine came. Verse 51. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all of my toil. You know, again, that Hebrew word translated toil means misery or pain or trouble or torment, or as we might call it today, adversity. And so Manasseh named him because it meant that God had helped him forget his suffering and all of his father's house, as we're told. And then verse 52, and the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction, or in the land of my adversity. And this is sometime after Joseph is in his early 30s. And so if we stop and reflect upon this for a moment before we continue, Joseph is standing before Pharaoh at age 30, and he's given now a tremendous amount of responsibility. We know he was in prison at least 2 years, because that was the distance or the length of time between the butler being released and Joseph going before Pharaoh. But what if Joseph was in prison for 5 years? Quite likely that he was. What if he was in prison for 10 years? Quite likely he was, because he was 17 when he was purchased by Potiphar. No doubt rose to prominence fairly soon after that. So Joseph could have been in prison from the age of 18 to 30, or 19 to 30, or age 20 to 30. Point is, there's a large gap, maybe as much as a third of Joseph's life at this point in time, that he spent in prison. So if all of us had just gotten out of prison this morning, and we had been in prison for 10 years, what would we have missed out on? You know, think about it in your own life, or in my life as well. It's 2015. We all went in prison in 2005. What would we have missed out on? You know, this is the kind of situation that Joseph was in. So we have to, you know, when we think of it in terms of the lessons that we are to learn and the lessons that Joseph went through, what does that mean? How would we have coped? And he was in prison for something that he did not do. Interesting, isn't it? So I think it's safe to say that Joseph had a lot of opportunity to think and to pray and to reflect upon his life, his hardship, his adversity, the trial that he was going through. And it's probably safe to say that Joseph learned a lot of patience. And Joseph certainly learned a lot of endurance. You know, God was working with him. He didn't know that he was going to be second in command of Egypt. And Egypt was a very powerful nation at that time. And Joseph was over the entire land, over everything except as matters that would come before the throne. So very powerful in that sense. Well, the story continues. The 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine happened as God revealed to Joseph. And it was soon after the famine began that Jacob sends his sons down to Egypt to purchase grain for the family. The famine has hit the land of Canaan. In fact, all of the area has been hit by famine. And so here, the first year of the famine, Joseph would have been about 38 years old. More than 20 years have now passed since he saw his family. They didn't know he was alive. He didn't know anything about his family either. And so the brothers come before Joseph in Egypt, and they are to purchase grain. And he recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. They don't know that it's Joseph. And so a dialogue between the brothers begin to take place. And Joseph accuses them of being spies. And now they have to prove to Joseph that they aren't spies. So let's pick up the story in Genesis 42 and beginning in verse 21. Genesis 42 and beginning in verse 21. And then they said to one another, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul." They saw the adversity on Joseph's face. They saw the suffering on his face and in his eyes when he pleaded with them after they threw him into the pit. Now 20 years has gone by, and these brothers now have carried this guilt. A lot of adversity on them, a lot of distress, and a lot of mental anguish that they no doubt have carried around for 20 plus years. "And we would not hear, and therefore," continuing in verse 21, "and therefore this distress now has come upon us." So what we put Joseph through now has come back to us. We now have our own adversity. And I think they probably recognized here that they had made a bad choice. In verse 22, "And Reuben answered them, and he said, 'Did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy?' But you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." So they are in mental anguish, the other boys, knowing that they had Joseph's life in their hands. And as far as they know, Joseph is dead. Verse 23, "But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. And he turned himself away, in verse 24, from them and began to weep. And then he returned to them again, and he talked with them, and he took Simeon from them, and he bound him before their eyes. And now the brothers have been accused of being spies. Joseph tells them what they have to do in order to prove that they aren't. They have to go back to Jacob. And Joseph's condition was that they would return back to Egypt with Benjamin. Benjamin being that second son from Rachel. And Jacob's heart, we're told, was already broken once by losing Joseph. And when the brothers tell him that this ruler of Egypt requires that they bring Benjamin back to Egypt, Jacob is beside himself. Now, the whole family is suffering through this. And apparently, the boys did not want to return. But in the second year of this famine, they realize that they have to go back. And so the brothers go back, and they take with them Benjamin, because they need the additional grain in order to survive. And so they return in the second year of the famine, and now they come before Joseph, although they didn't know it was Joseph, because the famine has made them desperate. And so they bring Benjamin with them. And we're going to skip through now a good part of the story. You can go back and read that on your own, but let's pick it up in Genesis chapter 45. And beginning in verse 4. And Joseph said to his brothers, Genesis 45, beginning in verse 4, "Please come near to me." And so they came near. And then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt." You know, at that point in time, the emotional outburst must have been staggering, as he revealed himself to his brothers. But he goes on, and notice in verse 5, he says, "But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." Joseph understood God's purpose and why he went through 20 plus years of adversity. Joseph understood that there was a reason that he went through what he was going through, and he recognizes that it was to preserve an inheritance for his family. Continuing in verse 6, he says, "For these 2 years of famine have been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting." You know, and Joseph would have been almost 40 years old at this particular point. Verse 7, "And God sent me." See, Joseph is now revealing a lot of the feelings and the understanding that he now has, knowing, as he's able to reflect back upon his life, that it was God's doing. And so in a sense, he's telling his brothers, "You know what? You have suffered, I have suffered, but this was really the will of God, because God had a greater purpose than we all recognized." And he says in verse 7, "God sent me before you to preserve a posterity," or to preserve your generation, "to preserve you in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance." Verse 8, "So now it was not you who sent me here, but God." Wow, what a point to come to, having endured what he endured, and the mental anguish that all of the boys would have gone through for 20 plus years. Joseph is saying, "It wasn't you, but it was God." So God's hand was in this whole period of Joseph's life that Joseph no doubt looked upon as a total trial and tribulation for him. But he understands now that it was God's will, and that God's purpose was at play when he was sent into Egypt. But he goes, "It was God who sent me here, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh," or he made him a counselor to Pharaoh, "and lord of all of his house, and a ruler throughout all of the land of Egypt." And so during this passage of time from the time that Joseph was 17, he understood God's purpose. He understood why he had to suffer, why he had to go through a great amount of adversity. What do you think Joseph learned about in terms of endurance? Do you think his endurance was stronger after 20 years? What about his patience? Do you think his patience, his long-suffering, was improved significantly? What do you think happened to his character that came out after 20-plus years in adversity? Do you think it was a lot better? Do you think it was more godly in that sense? What did Pharaoh see in him that Pharaoh was willing to turn over the kingdom to him? A Hebrew that the Egyptians despised. You know, Joseph went from the lowest level of human existence, a prisoner in the king's prison. Couldn't make a decision for himself, although that changed. But the lowest level of existence, totally under the power of somebody else, subject totally to the whim of Pharaoh and the guards in the prison. So he went from the lowest level of human existence to ruler of Egypt. That's a pretty fascinating story, isn't it? Is there a better rags-to-riches story that you can think of? Do you think Joseph was a merciful ruler in Egypt? Probably was, wasn't he? Because he was able to experience the things that he did. And so there were character improvements. There was a certain level of righteousness that God was able to groom and instill in Joseph going through what Joseph went through. And again, the lesson is recorded for us to understand that even though we may go through a year or 2 years or 5 years or 20 years or a lifetime of adversity, as long as God is in that process, it's just like Paul said, that's a light affliction compared to what's going to come out on the other side. Let's look at one other example. We're not going to spend as much time on it. And this is the example of David. Let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 12. God tells us that David was a man after his own heart, and God deeply loved David. But David brings a tremendous amount of adversity upon himself through a series of bad choices. David desires Bathsheba, and then of course that sets off a chain reaction that created a very difficult time in David's life, and really for the whole nation of Israel. And David has gone through this chain of bad decisions. He's not repented. Several sins have been committed. And God sends Nathan to come before David to bring a message from God. And Nathan presents this story to David about the rich king and the poor king, and how the rich king took the poor king's lamb and slaughtered it for his benefit. And so let's pick up the story in 2 Samuel 12, beginning in verse 5, because this little anecdotal story brought about a reaction that God was looking for. 2 Samuel 12, and beginning in verse 5. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As the Eternal lives, the man who has done this shall surely die. And he shall restore fourfold for the lamb, because he did this thing and because he had no pity." And then Nathan said to David, "You are that man, David." Now can you imagine David's countenance at this particular point in time? How did it change? Because David was stirred up emotionally based on this story that Nathan had revealed to him. How would David have reacted? What was his countenance like now? Nathan goes on, he says, "Thus says the Eternal God of Israel, And now here is God really speaking to David through the prophet Nathan. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. Now this is what God is telling David. He's going to walk him through everything in his relationship, or a summary of his relationship with God. So he said, I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And notice what God adds or says later. He says, and David, if that had been too little, I also would have given you much more. So here God was willing to bless David enormously. And then in verse 9 he says to David, why have you despised the commandment of the Eternal? To do evil in his sight, you've killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You've taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. If you remember, David made sure that Uriah was on the front lines. And so it wasn't technically David's sword, but spiritually speaking it was, as though David had killed him himself. Verse 10, now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Now here we see that David is going to go through a tremendous amount of adversity. We're not going to read this complete story this afternoon. You can do that yourself. It begins in 2 Samuel chapter 12, and it goes through the next four or five chapters. But David made a series of bad choices. David sinned. And it took God sending Nathan before him before he could get David's attention. And so now God, we see from this particular series of bad choices and sins, that there is a punishment that David is going to go through, because God understands that he has to learn a lesson from this. And David truly did learn from it. But let's go on in verse 11. He says, thus says the Eternal, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives from before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun. How would we have responded? What if we were in David's shoes? And so in verse 13, notice David's response. He says to Nathan, I have sinned against the Eternal. I did it. My fault. You think David was now humbled? Or at least in going through that process of being humbled. He didn't make any excuses here, did he? Didn't point the finger at someone else. Didn't try to tell Nathan that, well, you just didn't understand what I was going through at the time. I had this struggle. I had this issue. And in a moment of this or in a moment of that, this is what happened. And it really wasn't my fault. I mean, you know, it's not fair. You know, I love that expression that modern generation uses. Well, that's just not fair. What did David say? He says, I've sinned against the Eternal. Didn't make excuses. Knew exactly what he had done. And in that moment where God spoke to him through Nathan, in that moment, he understood his sin. He understood what he had done, and his response was pure. He spoke from the heart, I have sinned. And David knew that he was the only one responsible. And so Nathan tells David, he says, the Lord has put away your sin, you shall not die. You see, God knew that at that point that David's heart was broken. At that moment, his heart was broken and his heart was open to repentance. But God was going to allow David now to go through a period of adversity that was going to teach him about enduring and about growing, and God was going to work with him. God was going to allow David to go through a very difficult and troubling time of his life. But he wanted David to understand what sin produces. And the adversity that comes from sinning can be very difficult. But it was God's opportunity to teach David and to bring him to full repentance. And so God told David that certain things were going to come to pass because of the choices that he made. And God was going to teach him. And as the story goes, David had to flee for his life because Absalom, his son, attempted to overthrow and kill him. And so the tragedy that is introduced to us here, this continues on for 4, 5, 6 chapters in 2 Samuel. And David did go through a very, very difficult period of time. And he did go through a tremendous amount of adversity. But David also learned from this. And he repented deeply from his sin and for the actions that he went through. All you have to do is read Psalm 51, one of my favorite books of the Bible or chapters of the Bible. And hopefully most of us read that 2 or 3 times a year. Because that's the chapter that David pours out his heart to God. And so he recognizes that he sinned. And he recognizes that when he gave in to the desires of his eyes and his heart, that's what led to sin. And it caused a lot of needless suffering for David and his family. And so David did go through another period of adversity, but he was strengthened by it. His relationship with God even grew stronger after this. And then God records for us in Acts that David was a man after his own heart. That through this adversity, through this trial, through this suffering that David went through, God was able to improve even more upon David's character and upon David's patience, humility, and endurance. Let's turn back now to 1 Peter, 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, and I'm going to read from the New International Version. But in verse 19 of 1 Peter 2, it says, "For it is commendable if a man bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because he is conscious of God." You know, and again, think about the story of Joseph. He endured a number of years in prison because of something that he was accused of that he didn't do. Going on in verse 20, "But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and you endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God." Verse 21, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps." You know, Peter's showing here that to this you were called. Yes, we're called to a certain way of life. We're called to live a certain type of life, have a lifestyle that's reflective of being obedient to God, having God's Spirit in us. And that lifestyle, that way of life, at some point, will create adversity for us because we're going to be different than those around us. And that lifestyle or that way of life, as we call it, living our lives according to God's purpose, you know, it's caused a lot of adversity for people. I know a lot of families that have been split over this way of life. But Peter says that, you know, Christ also suffered, and that's the example that we all have to keep in mind, that there is trials, adversity that we do go through, where God says it is commendable that you're able to endure, grow, develop patience, because it's godly character that's being created in us. Now let's go back to Acts chapter 14. Acts 14 and beginning in verse 21. Acts 14 beginning in verse 21. "And when they had preached
the gospel to that city. Now, Paul's referring to the city of Derbe. That's in Greece. That's where they were at. And made many disciples. They returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch. You know, if you remember the story, Paul was stoned in Antioch, and he fled from there, and now they've returned. Verse 22, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith, and saying, or teaching them, expressing to them, showing them that through many tribulations we enter into the kingdom of God. So Paul knew that we would suffer, we would go through adversity, we would go through tribulation, we'd go through trials. Part of the process of growing spiritually is to face adversity. And that process that ultimately leads to being born into the kingdom of God does come with adversity. And we see that many, many times reflected in the Bible. And there are many examples of in the Bible. I've only looked at two this afternoon, but you know, we think of the example of Job and what he went through. And then there's the entire example of the nation of Israel. I mean, the Bible has books and books recorded about Israel's adversity because they refused to obey God and they kept straying away from God. And the amount of trial and tribulation that the nation of Israel went through is documented in great detail for us. And then there's other examples. We have Christ's own life, as was alluded to by Peter. You know, a life that we have examples where Christ went through suffering, not of his own fault, but to set the example. And then we have a great example in the parable of the prodigal son, someone who made bad choices, and then how that was resolved at the end. So the Bible shows us that a way of life that all of God's people have gone through during the course of centuries of time, all have one thing in common, and that is we will go through adversity as a part of this particular process. There will be trials, and there will be a certain amount of tribulation or suffering that we go through. Now let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. Preston beat me to this particular verse. In Hebrews chapter 12, and beginning in verse 7, and I'm going to read from the Revised Standard Version. Hebrews 12, and beginning in verse 7. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? And if you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children, and you are not sons. Verse 9. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? Verse 10. For they disciplined us for a short time at their pleasure, but He, this is referring to God, disciplines us for our good, that we may share His holiness, or that we may share His righteousness, and really, that we may share His family, that we may be a family with Him. Verse 11, for the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. And so the writer of Hebrews here is showing us that there are difficulties that we go through. And certainly the example of David shows us how discipline is a part of that process. But the reason that we go through adversity is for the character and the righteousness that it produces. And so here we're encouraged to know that if we are truly sons of God, we're going to face a certain amount of tribulation and trial. Now let's go to James chapter 1, another scripture that we're very familiar with as we wrap up here this afternoon. James chapter 1. James chapter 1 and beginning in verse 2. James 1, beginning in verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. You know, when we think about counting it as joy, we may not stand up and emotionally celebrate, but what James is trying to get across to us is that if we look at adversity and trials in the proper light, we understand that there is a certain joy that comes from it ultimately. Maybe not at the time, but ultimately there is joy that comes from it, because that joy is the goal that we're all hoping for and all seeking after. He goes on to say, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. You know, that's the goal. That adversity hopefully instills with us as it helps us to become perfected. You know, God is in the business of perfection. And it is His purpose that we as His children grow in His character and grow in His righteousness. So how should we? You know, we asked this question earlier. How should we view and deal with suffering and adversity? What's the approach? How do we deal with it? Where does it start? Well, it starts with our perspective and our attitude as we think about it and as we look at it. And so there are three basic things that I'm going to really just ask us a series of questions, because this gets at the heart of how we deal with adversity, how we deal with trials and tribulation. Number one, first point, am I going through this because of sin in my life? The question that we should ask when we are faced with certain things. Is there sin in my life? Did I stumble with God's Word? And if we ask God and we're diligent to seek His guidance and direction, if we have committed sin, God will reveal those sins to us. And so the first thing we look at is, have I caused this because of a sin that I created? Second point, what do I need to learn from what I'm going through? What's the lesson that I should learn? Did I make a poor choice? And because of that, I need to learn? What's it teaching me about my character? You know, if you make a poor choice, adversity comes before us, what do we learn? What's the character lesson that we need to look at? What's it teaching about our character, our endurance, our patience? You can even ask the question, well, then do I need to ask God for more discernment? You know, sometimes we do suffer because of bad choices that we make. And then finally, point number three, can I embrace this test? Can I embrace the test, the adversity, giving thanks to God for what I am learning and for what He will continue to teach me? You know, that's why James said we're to count it as joy, because God is going to teach us something, improve our character, improve our righteousness. So can I embrace this test? Is my faith strong enough to endure, knowing that God is not going to allow me to come under or bear something that I cannot stand? Is it more than I can bear? Can I embrace the test and appreciate what God is doing to improve my character and my righteousness? You know, God tells us that suffering, the tests, the trials that we go through, the adversity that we go through is part of our spiritual growth and part of our spiritual development. And so just as we are pushed physically to build stamina and endurance, we have to face adversity in order to build spiritual benefits, the spiritual endurance and the spiritual patience that we all need. And while we may not rejoice over adversity or suffering or trials or tribulation, hopefully as we think about this and knowing that God is, what God is doing, can we embrace the process? Can we appreciate the benefits that come from it? And can we appreciate what adversity will ultimately produce in all of us? I hope this afternoon that we all have a much better understanding of adversity and how we are to approach it and what it means for us. And as we face adversity in life, which we all will, that we'll be better prepared and a better understanding of how God is helping to groom us and mold us into His righteousness and in His character. I hope all of you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. There is a lot to be thankful for, and hopefully this is a week that we can thank God for our blessings and protection and for the family of God's people. Have a great week and a great Thanksgiving.